would be nervous too.
No, I'd be you very cannot nervous. Be serious.
My first podcast yesterday.
Okay, now, Don and Ivan, I say this every week or every time we have a guest, we pride ourselves, Don, don't we, Ivan, on having a diverse range of people.
You do. I just go along. I follow.
We pride ourselves, don't we, both of you, on having a diverse range of people. We've interviewed bikies. We've interviewed...
male... escorts.
We have. We've interviewed
porn
Miss
queens,
Nude, Miss Nude World, Miss Singers.
Singers.
And this today is no exception. This is another interesting person we feel that we would like to have a chat to. And she.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. She's a she. I am sure. Because she has children. So that would probably make her a she. I'm not sure that, despite what a lot of people say around the world in this woke world, that men can have give birth. I'm sure that this person is a woman. She is a specialist in mental health. She is a doctor of philosophy in health science at the La Trobe University. She's worked in conjunction with the AFL for 20-odd years, mentoring coaches and players and umpires about mental acuity. I'm making
mental
this
what?
Acuity. I'm making this up.
Well, what
she's
is acuity?
Going to, acuity, the fact that you're not mentally capable. Well,
you,
may you ask.
Why didn't you tell me all of this yesterday when I rang up to say, who is the guest?
Yeah, and I, do you know, I did exactly what
now you're telling me.
Don, she is sitting here patiently waiting for you to stop speaking crap. I did exactly when I knew who was coming in. I did exactly what I told you to do. Look up Mandy Ruddick, and I got all this information, which you could have got if you'd done your research. She is the psychology of sports industry she's in, and she's here with us today, and I want to welcome you, Mandy Ruddick. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Did I get any of that correct?
A little.
Tell me what I didn't get correct, please.
Shall I just simplify it a bit?
Yes, please.
I am an academic in the School of Psychology and Public Health at La Trobe University. My research area has been in mental health and wellbeing in high performance, and I'm the founder and director of Elevate Wellbeing and Performance.
Fantastic, Don.
So you haven't been connected to the Players Association because they did have somebody doing this type of thing?
I've done some research in conjunction with the AFL Players Association.
Right.
Yes. So as an academic, one of our roles is to undertake scientific research, and mine has been in the elite sports space, and that just happened to fall under the AFL banner.
So, Mandy, these are in quotes that you say that you your area of expertise is in elite performance mindset. You collaborate, connect and achieve with people. What, besides those euphemisms and bumper sticker words, which are to me, what do you do with coaches, players, umpires to overcome stress or anxiety or depression, or what is your field of expertise, please?
So can I take you back in time
please,
to how it all evolved?
Please take us back to wherever you like, because we'll ask you some questions when we understand what we're asking you.
Sure. So I was a semi-professional athlete myself. I was a swimmer and I also loved learning and education. So post high school, I undertook studies at La Trobe University and pursued a PhD in the field of health science. What that requires you to do is an independent piece of research to look into a topic that hasn't been examined anywhere within the country throughout the world. When I was researching a topic, having an understanding of elite performance myself, both in the physical aspect of it and the psychological aspect of it, I thought that my research would involve sport in some shape or form. So when I started to look into the research about psychological aspects of performance, I noted that there was a gap or a limitation in relation to the psychology of injury. So when I started to investigate this, a number of studies and sports had looked into this in the United States, overseas, etc., but nothing had been examined in the sport of AFL. And I thought, well, how fascinating. This is our country's most popular game, high levels of participation, but there had been no research undertaken in this area. So I thought, well, there's my market. I was going to look at the psychological impact of injury in the AFL.
This is interesting.
It is extraordinarily interesting. And if I could, just before I forget that what you just said then, overcoming the psychology of injury, is that the layman's way of saying pushing through the pain barrier or nothing to do with that?
No.
It's the mindset related to the injury.
So are there
not
many...
Not getting depressed because you are not able to perform at your highest level or... Please don't feel free to say we're clowns and have no idea what we're talking about.
Not at all. It's not necessarily looking at the deficit model, which is what we think about when we think about mental health. More often than not, when we hear the word mental health, we think of depression, anxiety, stress. It also encounters the positive aspect of the mental side. For example, flourishing, optimal performance.
Yes, got flourishing here.
So we look at the mental health continuum. So what makes an individual mentally healthy versus mentally unhealthy? And what the research identified that when elite performers, specifically sportsmen and women, obtain an injury, in this case it was a long-term injury, what were the psychological ramifications of that long-term injury?
So are you talking about the injury finishing their career?
Sometimes it could have finished their career. So my study specifically engaged with AFL players once they became injured, so within the first 7 days of their long-term injury.
So Mandy, if you're involved with the AFL over 20 years, if I was a player and came under your notice or vice versa, and because I was injured and I was struggling, what would our relationship be? What do you counsel me, or what would you do? How does that work if I'm one of your subjects?
And that's a great question, because with research, it is our role and responsibility to obtain data. So I wasn't there to counsel or to navigate an individual through their injury. I was there to record what their injury process was like for them.
So was there any common denominators, or are there common denominators that can be applied to each injured athlete?
What became apparent through my research, and this has been highlighted in previous literature before, is that when an elite athlete obtains an injury, they actually go through the grief process. So they, you know, stage one, anger, denial.
Yeah.
This has happened to me. Oh, why has it happened to me? Oh, it was that guy on the field.
Yes. We say that all the time, Don. Don't you get frustrated when you can't perform? You
but do. I don't get it. Well, I'm just kind of relating it to myself. You just go and get it fixed.
No, but this is part of the fixing program, not going and getting a heat lamp put on a bruise. This is part of the, I presume, this is part of the wellness fixing program of fixing you mentally, I presume, Mandy. Am I on vaguely on the right track?
I could nearly say spot on there, Sam.
Right. So this is not just this physical, mental and spiritual. The cat's mother is not dealing with heat lamps and fucking massage. She's dealing with massaging your brain, aren't you? Please?
If you would like to say it that way. But yes. what was found, and mind you, this research was sort of over 15 years ago now, so we have evolved dramatically in this area. So AFL clubs now have psychologists, they have welfare managers, they have wellbeing consultants, they have, you know,
dietitians.
They have all sorts of physiological experts, as well as what we could say psychological experts now. So this research was to obtain data to try and understand the injury process that high performance athletes would go through. And once we understand the process, we can then implement strategies or tools to actually enhance the recovery process for these individuals.
Mentally. Okay, so what's the process they go through?
What's the process? As mentioned, it was the grief process.
Yeah.
So that sort of stems from anger, denial, frustration. You would then go through the periods of lowness as well, isolation. You would try and bargain it within your brain. How am I going to rehab a bit quicker? What can I do? To hopefully towards the end you reach that acceptance stage.
So you have to be sort of a soothsayer, a whisperer. You have to convince people that they should have a different mindset about the grief and the anxiety and the frustration. And you say, no, you've got to look at this from a lateral... Is that right?
Yeah, so you pretty much look at it from a growth mindset. So we might have an 18-year-old who was coming to the system. They potentially have a 5-year contract. Okay, this year in front of them is a write-off, but let's look at the future performances. What do we need to do now to ensure that we can get the best result long-term for your performance as an athlete?
So would you say, I'm trying to just relate this, would you say this is in AFL because these guys have got nothing else and it's a very selfish, well, you when you're a top athlete, it's a very selfish way of living. They think of only themselves, and that's which you've got to do. I understand all that. But if they had other things to occupy instead of just being so set on their sport, this side wouldn't come into play as much, would it?
And it's interesting you should say that, because the research has actually shown that high performers that have other areas in their life to focus on appear to be a little bit more balanced, if we could say that, or they can invest their energy into something else. Research even shows that those that have family members as well seem to rehabilitate more effectively and efficiently than others. So,
family members, what do you mean by that?
A social support network. So instead of being an 18-year-old that comes home to an empty house thinking about, well, I need to get right because I need to get back and play, we have a 34-year-old that walks into the house and is greeted by 3 children, a partner. Let's change the conversation and hear about what the kids have been doing. So the focus is taken off the actual injury.
Don, I'm a bit like you, I think, and Ivan, that we're basically black and white people. We're shade in between that we probably haven't experienced, I don't think.
Well, I no, we? I
not in your day.
Well, no, I'm not sure. I don't think so. I'm trying
no,
to.
Well, doesn't it come back to you as an individual? Do people that achieve, okay, now, people that achieve or good at their, have they got a different mindset than the also rans who don't achieve? You know, does that
who
come
overcome
in?
It themselves?
Yes. As like a sports person, you've got to be, you know, to get to the top, you've got to be very
focused
and self-centered and whatever else, and have a strong mind. So an injury is just part of getting there, or I can overcome. Because I relate it back to my time, and a doctor said, I know, sorry.
It's because you're eating while the podcast's on, Don. That's the nuts and the muffin.
I know it was
the
throwaway line, but he did say to me that doctors who go into sports medicine are not really equipped to handle normal medicine because the mind of an athlete comes in and you can't measure it. Some have got a stronger mind than others, and some can achieve whereas others can't in a particular sport. Does that come into the rehabilitation of injuries as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we talk about resilience. We talk about one's ability to bounce back. But what we also need to remember in elite sport is that more often than not, it's an identity piece as well. So for an elite athlete, if they become injured, they can't go to training, they can't do their normal daily tasks, they start to lose their identity. So what do I do now?
Yes, what do you do? Then what do you do? And so we get this back to the AFL. It says you're involved for 20-odd years with coaches, players and umpires. We forget the umpires, but they probably suffer just as much grief and stress as probably more than because they can't do much about their stress. Don could go and belt the first little bloke he saw if someone upset him, but the umpires can't quite do that. So how did the AFL engage, did they engage you to come and oversee the well-being and mental acuity, if you like, of the people under their wing, coaches, players and umpires?
And I guess it all came down to the research that I did and the connections that I made along the way. I'm a Melburnian, never followed a team growing up, had no understanding of the game. So for me to walk into the AFL industry and undertake research in it, it was really unique. And those people along the way that either, you know, inspired me or motivated to do better, aka David Parkin, yeah, or a Peter Rode and a Terry Wallace who gave me the first opportunity in the industry. They backed me in my role, and I guess for me especially, I guess from a personal perspective, once you start to believe in yourself, show your self-worth, my research became quite popular internationally. And
I see internationally. You've recognised what you do internationally?
My research has been published in international journals.
Well, I should have read that in your bio, which I didn't quite get down to that. I apologise about that, Mandy. So AFL, of course, we keep going on about, but you're in the ballet? You treat ballet?
One of my students was doing some research with the Australian Ballet. As an academic, we supervise students, and one of my PhD students was looking at mindfulness interventions with the Australian Ballet.
Mindfulness interventions.
So once again, it comes back to that high performance environment. So whether it be football, ballet, athletics, soccer, yeah, athletics, whatever it is, more often than not, those athletes want to perform to their best. They want to win a grand final, be the opener in the national performance for the ballet, whatnot. And what we have seen is that sometimes the psychology of the performance or the injury is downplayed as opposed to the physiology of it. So if we're a footballer, you twing a hamstring, you come off the ground, it gets iced, we rehabilitate. For a dancer, as an example, let's say we're starting to get acute arthritis in our feet because we perform on our feet morning, noon and night. We might start to mask the pain with anti-inflammatories. We might start to self-talk and say that we're going to push through this, we're going to get through this. But what we tend to see, or past history has shown us, that the emphasis on the psychology of returning to high performance post-injury has been less emphasised than the physiological performance.
Now, I'm sorry to be naive about this, and you'll appreciate that I'm extremely naive about this. At some stage, you surely must engage on a one-on-one basis with people. You must engage on a one-on-one basis with people who are experiencing these difficulties, or do you just lecture to a group of people in a room? Or how do you manifest your expertise? How does it spread to people unless you engage with them personally? And I get back to me. If I was off injured and I was doing it tough and I was getting annoyed and all that, would you say, you better come into my office and we'll just go through? Or is that how it works? Or
it's part of the parcel, because what we have seen is in relation to human connection and the importance of speaking out, speaking openly with challenges, etc. I'm not a registered psychologist, so I don't do one-on-one consultations with individuals, But part of the research process is that you learn about the experiences that individuals are going through, and then you unpack the data to try and put it into something meaningful.
So how this was one of the key things in your you said you overcoming the pain barrier. We've probably just discussed that, but how do you overcome the pain barrier? Pain is a physical thing that is pervasive, and how do you overcome that? When you were a swimmer, did you push through the pain barrier, and is this what motivated you to do this? Because you were a self-motivating person, you thought, I can contribute to other people who quite don't have my perseverance.
I've always wanted to connect with people, and I guess my motto, both personally and professionally, has been to make a difference, and whether that's to one individual, a group, a team, or an organisation. So with the data that I've obtained from my research, whether that be with players, coaches, umpires, high-performance coaches, whatnot, I engage with organisations to show them the data, to show them the evidence, in hope that they will take it on board and try and construct really useful strategies, policies or programs for their employees who happen to be elite sports people.
Now, Mandy, you've been doing this for 20 years, and I'll ask this delicately, is the older players more resilient than the newer players now?
Great
question. Is there something there that...
It's taken us 21 minutes for someone to ask you a great question. Well done, Ivan. No, that's right. So people are softer these days, aren't they?
I'm trying to say it nicely.
There's been a big shift to what we have seen in the past. And no doubt you gentlemen can relate. So when you were athletes, you were also full-time workers. You were probably doing multiple other things as well, whereas athletes today, that is generally their full-time job. We don't often see people working full-time and being athletes full-time. It's starting to emerge now, but there still appears to be that imbalance. So the research has actually shown that those that have other avenues, outlets, activities, support networks are able to enhance their coping mechanisms for stressful situations.
It's a case of insecurity too. If you just mentioned that older athletes are able to handle the situation better, they're far more secure than somebody on the way up who's wishing to establish or break into. Would that be correct?
Absolutely, yep.
And you as a sports person yourself, were you able to relate a little bit better, do you think? You've got a walk-up start because you understand, have got a little bit of empathy for what they're going through?
Yeah, I thought that really assisted, knowing that I understand what an athlete goes through. But you talk about the security. So one of the main reasons why I walked away from my sport of swimming was because there was no financial reward in it for me. So I thought, well, I need to go and get a job, get some financial backing behind me, and I jumped out of the water.
So one of the unintended consequences, if you like, of coaching is the fact that it says here that they get burnt out or they lose their significance. They can only so many ways you can tell people to do things without making it sound appealing on a daily basis. Is this one of the great problems of people who are earning $1 million a year coaching and suddenly because their side doesn't go too well they get the flick? Is this this would be stressful in itself, wouldn't it?
Of course it would. It's like every other employment.
Pretty obvious question that, Dom, wouldn't it?
Employment is stressful, but the major difference between you and I is if we have a bad day at work, we don't see it on the front page of the paper. We don't read about it in social media. It's not a win-loss ratio for you and I in relation to our job.
But isn't that part of it? This kind of infuriates me a little bit because this is part of the territory you're going into. You've got to know that this is... You know, it frustrates me that the players don't front up to a media conference afterwards. You know, that should be part of you're receiving the accolades and the financial reward because of this sport. And you should be able to handle this. It just goes, and if you can't handle it, we'll get out. Is that too simplistic?
Not necessarily. So it's part of your job. It's part of your roles and responsibility as an athlete or as a coach. And what we have seen from the research and what has evolved is that coaches are well aware of the fact that more often than not, there's always going to be a target on their back. It's just a matter of time when they get hit.
Yes.
Brilliant quote that Mick Malthouse actually shared with me at one stage. But what we found with the coaches in particular was they do it for the love of the game. They do it for the satisfaction of developing their players, their group. Yes, they obviously do it as well for the wins, for the accolades, a premiership winning team, etc. But the research that I did with AFL senior coaches at the time, the most prominent theme to emerge was in relation to the development of their group.
So you mentioned they do it because they like the game for ego. You didn't mention what I would have thought would be the main reason they do it in the first place, and that's for the money. No, I'm not. That would be my cynical view of it. I would say people get out of coaching and think we'll get back into it because they went from earning $1 million coaching, and then they lifestyle it was what it was, and then suddenly they weren't earning, and they thought, well, we're career football people. I'll have another go at coaching someone. Not speaking about anyone that's just been appointed, like Ross Lyon or anything like that, but I would say the fiscal reward from it almost outweighs, and you would disagree with that.
I wouldn't disagree with that totally, because you know, every human being, if someone was offered you a job with a bigger pay packet somewhere else, more often than not, you would take it. You would...
Like the live golf.
You would go with the pay packet because that can provide a secure future for you. However, because of the nature of high-performance sport, the time, the commitment, and I reflect on something like Olympic coaches. So that is not always necessarily a full-time gig. So if you're a national coach or Olympic coach or whatnot, you're doing it for the love of it because the financial reward is not there.
No, that's true. Quite true.
So it's almost like comparing apples to oranges, because high-performance coaches, what we have seen across the board is that they do it for the development of their athletes.
Absolutely.
So going forward, would you say, we're talking about AFL, those other sports, they're struggling, they don't receive the publicity, you know, and they fly under the radar, so-called radar. But do you think going forward that, you know, we should be going back to a semi-professional game for the well-being of the athletes involved?
I don't feel as though that the evolution of the game has impacted the well-being of the AFL players, if that's what you're referring to.
No, I'm talking about, you know, you did your study into the mind of them handling an injury. That's just part and parcel. To me, I can't relate to that. You know, you're playing the game, you're going to get injured, we'll get the thing right and get out again, or be able to have the ability to carry that injury or develop your game such that you disguise that injury, yet you can still be effective.
So can I ask you this then? Reflecting on your comment just there, you get an injury right physically. The doctor, physio says to you, you're good to go. You send your player out on the field. Now they have increased anxiety. They're apprehensive about going into a competition in case they get another head knock. What is your interpretation of that? How would you manage or deal with that?
I can't answer that question because I can only relate it to myself.
And oh, she's asking about you.
Yeah, okay. I told them when I was ready. In other words, if I could do what I set out to do, I would go out. In fact, I think in my 15-year career, there might have been only, I don't know, 3 or 4 seasons that I played injury-free.
So what does ready mean for you?
As long as I can get out there and perform to a reasonable, as I said to you, injury-free only about 4 seasons, you know, but you're carrying injuries the whole time. It's your ability to overcome this so-called pain. And so you just had to perform. So you have different facets to your game to overcome that weakness that you're carrying.
But potentially your motives back then were very different to the motives today.
No different at all, because it was a financial, we gained financially, and no, not at all. Not at all. Well, yeah, you're a classic example over here. He had his ankles, both ankles reconstructed.
Yeah.
He played in the ruck, then had to adapt and go and play at centre-half forward.
Yeah.
So he's and he was out for a whole season with, I think, a liver complaint. He's had his liver. So he is able to overcome. You know, you've just got to overcome and continue on.
That, in answer to your question, what you asked him, how would you know? I probably played like Don. Most of my, which would be more than 50% of my career, I played in games against my better judgment, just because I was competitive, wanted to play, loved the game, and I couldn't honestly remember a game after more than playing for more than 3 years where I ever played a game where I wasn't had some sort of reasonably annoying and nagging injury. But you smiled when Don said, he said, I just knew I was ready, and you smiled at that. And you said, he said he was no different from people today. You smiled at that. Why was he different? Why do you think that's different today?
What I was reflecting on was some of the data that I obtained in my study.
Mm-hmm.
And those who had had a long-term injury were given the all clear physically. You have rehabilitated.
Yep.
Your body is 100% back to where it needs to be. The next part of the conversation within my research was around the apprehension.
Yes.
The worry.
Anxiety, yep.
The concern. What if I don't perform to the standard that I left and my contract is no longer renewed? So there were lots of other variables that then came into play for those particular individuals which you have already suggested, may have nothing else to fall back onto should they not perform at a really high standard.
Those things you just mentioned then are absolutely relevant. I don't care what he says. They would be factors that concern me and him, and that would be no different from us today than what you mentioned about players today.
And in that time, were probably never spoken about.
Probably, which gets us on to Don, and this is probably not in your jurisdiction or under your purvey. What is that word? Purvey.
No, I'll leave you with that.
The head injuries called? What are they called? What are they head injuries called when people play with concussion? That's nothing to do with you, I presume.
It is not. No, that's not obviously my area, but unfortunately I've friends and colleagues who are experiencing it at the moment as a result of.
So this is a thing from we used to get belted around and hit in the head and we'd get headaches.
And I say more?
Need you say more. We are complete buffoons. And we would take aspirins and we've never looked at the consequences, whether we have any that are apparent at the minute. But that's a thing that's manifested itself into a cottage industry, isn't it?
It's a massive industry at the moment.
Is it a massive industry, or is it people just
taking advantage of a situation?
Pardon us saying that.
I can't make any comment in relation to that.
No.
But what I've seen and heard is that there are effects that are happening as a result of something. And I guess this is why more research has been undertaken, but unfortunately that particular research has to occur when the individual has deceased.
Now, one of the words you mentioned before we started all this, or just as we got into it, was the word, and I had written down here, flourish. Just explain, flourish means, what, have you got to come out of your shell or be confident? What does that mean? In the context of what we are discussing, because I saw that in your when I researched you, and you mentioned it here verbally. What does that mean?
So flourishing, it's more so being towards the mentally healthy end of the scale. So when we talk about mental health, it sits on what we call a continuum, the mental health continuum. At one end of the continuum, we have the mentally unhealthy individual, so who may be showing signs and symptoms of clinical depression, anxiety, etc. At the other end of the scale, we have what we call flourishing, So we have an individual who is thriving in life. They are achieving, they are healthy, they have appropriate support networks, coping mechanisms, etc. So within any organisation, to ensure optimal performance, whether that be in sport or just in the workplace, we would like our individuals to be pushing towards the flourishing end of the scale. Because if someone is heading towards flourishing, we know we're going to get the best out of them. If someone is starting to languish, obviously that's going to show in their results, whether it be on the sporting field or in the boardroom, in the office, etc.
Have you had any indirect, not associated, is this driven, is the logical extension, the dramatic logical extension of this suicide? Do you know, is this a thing that we don't hear anything of, that athletes who can't cope and just push to the edge of this mental stress, is this part of suicide, the final unfortunate consequence of all this, or you haven't experienced any of that?
Well, what we are hearing and seeing are the stats in relation to mental health. The COVID pandemic has obviously exacerbated what is happening in society. We were disconnected, we were isolated, our workplace became our home place became workplace. People lost various abilities to connect and thrive and flourish in their day. So as a result of COVID and what we have seen in sport is that people are starting to openly disclose mental health conditions. And, you know, the stats inform us that one in five will experience a mental health condition in their life. So that doesn't necessarily have to just be an athlete or 20% of the population. If you do unpack that a little bit further, it's actually one in three athletes will experience a mental health condition in their life.
Do you think it's a reflection of society?
Potentially, yes.
Whereas in years gone by, this wouldn't have surfaced. You just had to get on and get on with life, fix it up yourself, crack hardy, just get on. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Just move on.
It's a very different mindset, I feel.
Society is different too, do you think?
Society is very different as well. Because if I was having this conversation with someone like my father, this wouldn't even resonate for him because it wasn't something that was of a topic of discussion back when he was growing up, or he was actually a coach and athlete himself.
Yes, so exactly.
That's probably very similar to you, gentlemen.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I find it difficult.
Yes.
You know, even in the workplace, you've got all these psychological problems, whereas, you know, you've got to go through. If somebody didn't measure up, you just sack them, get somebody else, you know, but you've got to go through this whole rigour now with regard to employees. So, in other words, I think society's become very much softer.
So, Mandy, how would I know if I'm suffering from mental stress? Maybe I'm mentally stressed, and I don't know it. How do you? What is? I'm not sure that I flourish in anything I do these days. I'm antisocial, and I don't go out, and I just plod from one day to another. Maybe I'm in all that. I'm going all right, but how would you know if you're not?
Yeah, so there are various signs and symptoms that you can look out for, and it's interesting, Sam, that you said that, you know, you don't go out that much anymore, and maybe that's changed since COVID.
It's just
old age. Yeah, is it?
Well, maybe just, or not putting up with all the nonsense and crap you put up with, speaking to ignorant people and imbeciles and people buttonholing you about things and not wanting to engage in with morons. There's a nice cynical attitude to life. Maybe I am suffering mentally. Mandy.
So if we just try and unpack that a little bit, Sam, just in relation to stress,
yep,
as an example, and whether that be occupational stress, so stress that you feel within your workplace. Signs and symptoms might be just tiredness, lacking energy, feeling unmotivated, interruptions with sleep, whether that be too much sleep or not enough sleep, changes in appetite, behaviours, etc. So these are sort of some of the things that you should be thinking about or looking for.
I don't wish to bring this back to me, but I had my ankle fused a year ago, and that has been, that has, you talk about tiredness and frustration, and that has been so sore, and to this day is so sore, and I thought, if I have to go through the rest of my life with that, someone even said, why don't you amputate your foot? And they said, there's very good prosthetic feet out there. I said, are you serious? When would you think that would get hold of your brain and you'd think, what's this all about? I don't even know what I'm asking you. But that putting up with that, I reckon I do a very good job. And Don does too. Don rides horses and has a lot of physical complaints than I do. But we push on. Should we not be pushing on? Should we just be winding down a bit?
Well, because I don't think it's foreign to us. Pushing on, but it's... the question you would ask is, how much is that impacting your daily life and your function?
I couldn't tell you how much that is impacting my daily life. That is consumes my whole life, that, because I can't walk properly. Mm-hmm. And I've never had that problem before ever. Sounds like I'm whinging, doesn't it? But this is how it does get hold of you. And I'm just wondering, maybe it's got hold of me and I haven't realised it.
Potentially it has, Sam. And I guess in today's workplaces... these types of situations are what organisations are hoping to avoid in the future. So they're trying to create an environment, and you used the word holistic earlier in the interview.
Holistic.
About, being person-focused in an organisation now. So understanding the individual. It's not just about the process of making money for the company, but I want, the best people working for me within the company. So how do I get that? What does that mean? What does that look like if I was the CEO of an organisation?
So, Mandy, if you weren't here today batting back all these nonsensical questions that we're asking you, if you weren't here today, what is your day consist of? Do you sit in front of a Word, a computer, analysing data from around the world? What do you do? Do you go out to businnesses or what?
Yeah, how does great
your,
question.
What so is I your have, day involved?
I have
doing?
Multiple roles, part-time of a number of things, and then obviously a full-time mother, as you highlighted there, Sam. But I'm, as an academic, let's say pre-COVID, my roles and responsibilities were obviously lecturing, tutoring, facilitating the next gen of our leaders and healthcare professionals in particular.
And you have a tenure at the university. I am asking you who pays your salary.
So the university,
yes,
pays my salary.
Right.
I have a teaching and research position.
Yes.
So teaching whereby I have to
lecture people?
Lecture, yep, and facilitate tutors and whatnot. And then the research position is in relation to what we've just been talking about here. It's it's real world situations. It's what's having an impact. What knowledge can we gain and then bring back into the classroom? And
do you collate data and information with your peers and colleagues from around the globe, or
maybe not around the globe, but within my university and different universities? Yes.
Yes, in the Western world, anyhow. Yep.
Yes.
Don,
I think it's a fascinating subject, and it's
fascinating.
I think it's arisen in society as it is today. We're looking for answers. You mentioned about COVID and the isolation of COVID. I thought it brought home COVID that we are a social animal. Humans are a social animal that needs interaction. Mm-hmm. And anyway, that's another issue altogether. But there is a basic underlying theme for all of this, isn't it? That you've got to be aware of your situation and doing something about it. Is that right, or are people unable to recognise what is going wrong with them?
So self-awareness is a huge component, and something that we've become more aware of since the COVID period. So knowing ourselves, understanding ourselves, and then being able to relate that to others that we might be working with or performing with as an athlete or whatnot, So self-awareness is actually a really important component when you're starting to unpack well-being, wellness, resilience.
Do you find it frustrating working with athletes that are physically all right but mentally unable?
I mentioned I don't do a lot of one-on-ones.
Oh, I see.
It's inevitable because the mind plays such a powerful role in performance, and if you speak to any sports psychologist or psychological performance individual, what we don't probably talk about as much as we should is the psychological component of the game. So if you were to speak to an elite athlete, you know, one that has been so instrumental, let's say a Roger Federer, who just recently retired, he would be able to unpack every aspect of his performance or his craft, both physically and psychologically. He would have, no doubt, a psychological performance routine set in stone that would be instrumental in his on-court performance.
But would he need assistance psychologically?
Absolutely.
You think so? Mm-hmm. Top athletes require that.
Top athletes need, as you've said, someone to connect with. So if they feel as though maybe there's a particular strategy that I would like to implement, I've read about it, what do you think about this? What's the research shown us in relation to strategy A? Is that going to enhance my performance? So as athletes, they're always wanting to gain that extra 1%.
Exactly.
So the question then is asked, well, how do they get that? What do they do?
It's a fascinating subject. I think it comes back to the individual. Not you go out and get these top athletes know themselves inside out, their game inside out, and the go and whatever else. So wherever they can fine tune themselves instead of getting advice from someone else, how does that apply to me? They know themselves better than anybody else.
No doubt, but they also would recognise that as human beings, we have a limitation. There is always some deficit, and if you want to improve that deficit, sometimes you can't answer those questions yourself.
Well, one of the biggest issues, mental health, with top athletes would be when they get to their end of their career. Is there a debrief or something that the AFL do to transition these people or top athletes from playing to normal life?
Transition's a huge phase, especially in the sporting space. We all transition through life. It might be, you know, as a preschooler to primary school, secondary school, the worker out into retirement or whatnot. So it's a really key component of an individual's life process. I am aware of sporting organisations that offer transition programs for their athletes, and more often than not now they start those before the transition process actually occurs. The Australian Institute of Sport is doing some great research and implementing a lot of practicalities in that space as well, but it can be very unique to each organisation.
Well, now, Mandy Ruddick.
Fascinating.
Don, it's actually enjoyable to be so far out of your depth in some things that you learn on the job. And we've probably asked you the most ridiculous questions. I don't know if you've ever done a podcast before or been interviewed before, but I bet you've been never asked any of the questions we've asked you.
It's been a very unique experience.
Yes, a unique experience. And I don't care if I shouldn't say this because you are an extremely capable and competent person, and we are delighted that you came in here. Not only are you extremely capable and competent, you're a very attractive-looking person too, which would has got nothing to do with, but I just thought I'd say that gratuitously. You held up something there that you want
Thank
to...
Thank you, Sam.
Yeah,
well, I guess probably something that has evolved from the COVID pandemic in relation to the well-being space, and something that I was self-aware of during COVID and wanted to reconnect with numerous professionals who had a really strong area of expertise in mental health and well-being. So I reached out to numerous professionals that I have crossed paths with in my career as an athlete working in the AFL in the sporting space.
Why did you do that?
Because I wanted to connect as well during COVID. It was a time of isolation. I also wanted to hear about what others were doing in this space. I wanted to understand if there was more research that I needed to know about too. So I reached out to numerous Professionals who have implemented programs that are evidence-based, guided by theory and frameworks, and we have since, you spoke about that word, those words in the beginning, connect, collaborate and achieve. So we have created Elevate Wellbeing and Performance, and we are a unique group of professionals that actually engage with organisations, sports groups, communities to discuss mental health and wellbeing aspects, to speak about strategies, tools that you can utilise in your toolbox to ensure that you are pushing towards that flourishing end of the scale.
Did you have any names that we would recognise?
I have got some wonderful names. We have Clint Bizzle, who's an executive coach. We've got Bill Nelson, who's also an executive coach. Bill was an international and Olympic swimming coach.
Yes.
Hayden Kennedy, who was an AFL umpire. Yep. He was also the AFL umpire's coach for a number of years. We've got Anthony Clarica, who was a sports psychologist, worked with numerous AFL clubs, numerous sporting organisations. Brad McEwen, who was a Channel 10 sports journalist, and he is a mental health advocate. We've got Joe Parner, who his field is in relation to emotional fitness. We've got Dr. Carly Harrison, who I was referring to in relation to mindfulness with the Australian Ballet, and then myself.
And you, Mandy Ruddick, what a star, Don. I'm going to have another crack at this. She is the Director of Philosophy in Health...
Doctor of Philosophy.
Doctor. Doctor of Philosophy. Because you said you weren't a doctor and that threw me.
PhD, medical doctor. PhD.
Yeah, like a Doctor of Music. Doctor of Philosophy in Health Science at the La Trobe University. Now, Mandy, we're very grateful that you came in, and it was a fascinating topic. And we really appreciate you being here, for You Cannot Be Serious.
Thank you for having me. What an experience.